The weather presenter glides in front of their green screen backdrop, and with just a few symbols, we are conditioned to know exactly how to interpret tomorrow. It's going to rain, there'll be some sunny breaks, and oh yeah, look at this beautiful picture of some cows in a field. But weather forecasting, my friends, is much more complex than that. It is not some art form, it is science. Physics, to be exact. On this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we're looking at, you guessed it, the weather, and asking, how do you make a reliable forecast? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and this is the show where we seek out the brightest minds at the University of Oxford, and we ask them to weigh in on those tricky questions. You know, the ones that could change the way we understand the world as we know it. This series has been exploring a lot of different areas of science. We've already heard about seabirds and bacon, and this time, yeah, it's weather. So to help us answer this big question, I headed to a weather station near one of the beautiful parks in Oxford with Dr. Hannah Christensen, a postdoctoral researcher in atmospheric, oceanic, and planetary physics.
So a lot of people are very surprised when I say that I'm a physicist and I work on weather forecasting, because they associate the weather and the climate more with geography or with earth sciences. But actually the reason that I'm a physicist studying the weather is because of the way we make a weather forecast.
I think it's pretty fair to say that this country is obsessed with weather. And Hannah is just the same. When she was very young and she was in school, she loved learning about clouds and weather formations, but her teachers seemed to keep weather and physics separate.
In physics, we were being taught why you get a current through a circuit and the structure of an atom, and these didn't seem so relevant to me. I always had this interest in the weather, and then I was very pleased when I found out that my aptitude for maths and physics could really be played out in this field I was interested in.
Physics and weather have a very close link. When it comes to building a forecast, it requires solving a series of equations about the atmosphere. Things like how air flows around the planet and how the sunlight then warms that air.
The kind of equations that you learn as a third year physics undergraduate, but solving these equations is quite complicated. And it's particularly complicated for making a weather forecast because we're trying to solve them over such a large area. So we're trying to solve these equations at every single point over the whole planet.
So in order to predict what the weather will be like in the future, researchers like Hannah build a computer simulator. It just looks like a million lines of code that is split up into different chunks to deal with different parts of the model. Then Hannah needs to figure out a starting point.
The first thing we need to do is to work out what the atmosphere looks like today. And that's a harder problem than you might anticipate, really, because we want to find out what the temperature of the air is, what the wind speed and direction is at every point over the Earth. And so obviously we don't have a weather balloon that we can send up from every square meter, and we don't have enough rain gauges and things to measure how many clouds and how much precipitation, how much rain there is. So what we do is we use satellites to fill in the gaps, really, and satellites can measure how much heat is being emitted from the atmosphere, and so they can work out the temperature structure of the atmosphere.
Then comes time to run the simulator forward. The computer tells Hannah what the temperatures look like, what the winds are doing, and then she does this about 50 more times, just slightly changing the starting point to get a complete picture of all of the possible outcomes of what the weather could do.
And you see that sometimes these forecasts will track along each other and we're very confident in our prediction, and other times they can spread out widely. And so it's then up to a forecaster to take this information and to look in this forecast and see, oh, there's some very strong wind speeds here, there's a very low pressure here, I can see that there's a front coming in. And they can then interpret this information and produce the forecast, which you then see on the television or that you look at on the internet.
But it hasn't always been this way. It wasn't too long ago that we did not have satellites to fill in the gaps. And yeah, in the 70s, computers came into play, but even then, they were not nearly as sophisticated as what we hold in our hands daily. So back in the day, Hannah says, forecasters relied on a system of analogs to predict the weather.
So an analog is the name given to the process of looking at what the weather is like today and then scanning back through our historical records for a day when the weather looked a bit similar, and then seeing what happened in the past from that day and making that as our forecast for today.
The reason analogs are a problem touches on chaos theory. Chaos theory is a part of mathematics, and it's not as scary as it sounds. It's just where you have a very complex system, and it's highly sensitive to the slightest change. So think of the butterfly effect. Whether or not a butterfly decides to flap its wings can influence the track of a tornado.
But then if we think about this idea of using analogs, what we've done is we've looked through the past record for a day that looked a bit like today. But I mean, if that day didn't have these butterflies in it and today did, then really the future track of the weather is going to be very different from the two. So you can't really use analogs for that.
Fast forward to the 1980s. We're now using computer simulators to make predictions. But the problem of chaos, or the butterfly effect, remains. And perhaps the most notorious example of it going wrong, and Hannah's favorite, is the forecast made by BBC's Michael Fish prior to the Great Storm of 1987.
Good afternoon to you. Earlier on today, apparently, a woman rang the BBC and said she heard that there was a hurricane on the way. Well, if you're watching, don't worry, there isn't. But having said that, actually, the weather will become very windy, but most of the strong winds, incidentally, will be down over Spain.
The following morning, people woke up across the south of the UK to scenes of devastation.
At least 18 people were killed. Ferries were beached, roads were blocked, power lines and phone lines went down, and about 15 million trees were damaged.
The root of this problem is that all Michael Fish had to go on was a best guess forecast for what the weather was coming up. And in his best guess forecast, it looked like there wasn't a big windstorm coming. But if you repeat that forecast with a modern forecasting system and you make 50 forecasts, which are all equally possible, you see that about 20 of them actually show this really big storm coming. And so what that tells us is that the atmosphere on that night was extremely unpredictable. It was very hard to tell whether this storm that was kind of visible on the horizon was going to sweep across the UK as it did, or if it would sweep south and miss us. So unfortunately, Michael Fish gave the most likely case, which was that it would miss us, but there was a chance that it would hit, and that's what happened. And really, it's been the growth of the computer. So we now have much bigger and faster computers than we used to, so we can afford to make many forecasts. Because really, I mean, the constraint with weather forecasting is that you need these forecasts to finish running on the computer before they're needed. So there's no point in making a really detailed prediction if it's ready for you to look at after the event has actually happened.
The birth of the satellite era and all the computers that we have access to means it's unlikely that we'd get caught out with a giant surprise like the Great Storm. But that doesn't mean observational data and measurements from weather stations aren't important. They are all pieces of a puzzle that researchers need to be able to create a forecast. Hannah says, to this day, there are still spots on the Earth that they're just a bit of a mystery to us.
One of the regions of the globe where we have the fewest of these measurements is the Congo Basin. And actually, the Congo Basin is one of the three most important regions of the world for finding very big thunderstorms. And these big thunderstorms are obviously very important when we're working out the water cycle and the balance of rain and evaporation. But also, they're so violent and so energetic that they move huge amounts of air from close to the ground up to high in the atmosphere through these clouds, and that forces the movement of air around the whole planet. And the problem is the Congo Basin is extremely poorly sampled by ground-based measurements. So I think there are something like only 10 ground-based weather stations there, and I mean, If you look at a distribution of stations over the UK, there are hundreds and hundreds, and that's a much smaller and much less important area.
The Congo Basin is massive. It follows the path of the Congo River in West Equatorial Africa, and it is not just the scientific community that has interest in it. Hannah says humanitarian organizations also want to understand what kind of weather to expect in the region.
If you can predict the likelihood of a drought or of flooding, then this is something that they can use when planning relief programs If they know that there's going to be a lot of standing water in this region, so there might be more mosquitoes than normal, then they can start moving out equipment, so mosquito nets, for example, to that region in preparation.
But making an accurate long-range forecast is tricky, and Hannah knows all about that. She is working on tweaking the code that we use to predict the weather. Her goal, to make a reliable 10-day forecast.
What we see is that about every 10 years, we improve our forecasting window by 1 day. So that means that if you're using a 5-day weather forecast today, that's as good as a 3-day weather forecast was 20 years ago. So we are measurably improving the forecasts. But I mean, this is really an enormous community effort that's going into this. So there are hundreds and hundreds of scientists who are all incrementally improving these models.
Are we actually good at predicting the weather these days?
I think we are pretty good at predicting the weather, yeah. People tend to have a bias towards remembering days it went wrong. If you actually try and think objectively about the weather forecast, often we do get it right.
That said, don't ask her if it's going to rain on your wedding day. Unless, I guess, your wedding is a few days away. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks for the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons, and a special thanks to Dr. Hannah Christensen. Tell us what you think about this podcast. You can go to Twitter, tweet us at Oxford Sparks, find us on Facebook, or you can find a lot of other cool stuff on our website, oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. I'm Emily Elias, and until next time on the podcast, when we ask, can exhaust fumes cause dementia? Bye for now.